To start off, one of the slides I was going to present to you was an overview of the structure of the presentation. And basically, the main topics I would like to go through with you are what is biological warfare, give you a brief historical overview, how to see how the technology has developed over the ages. And then perhaps we come to one of the key parts. It's namely, what are the biological weapons we know of today, and what is the military utility of them? From there, I will move on to what control regimes exist on biological weapons, prohibitions on use, prohibitions on possession and production of such weapons. Then, in terms of the central theme of this conference, we're going to come to the concept of technology. That's not a biological weapon. They're silent. So we're going to expand the concepts of technology and dual use to come to the issue of technology transfers. And on the basis of these insights, I will conclude with some thoughts on how to strengthen the control regimes on biological weapons. Now, first of all, I have to give you a definition of biological warfare. You will assume automatically that biological warfare involves living organisms, but then if I were to take you in my arms and throw you against somebody else in anger, this would also be biological warfare because I'm using a living organism to hurt somebody else. This is, of course, not the concept. A definition which is derived from technical literature from the Convention on Biological Weapons is the following, and I'll read it slowly so you can follow. So, biological warfare involves the application of disease-causing organisms or toxins, which are poisonous substances produced by living organisms or their synthetically manufactured counterparts. And the use of these disease-causing organisms and toxins is against humans, animals, or plants, and you do it for hostile purposes. So the reason for the hostile purposes is important, of course, because if you use an organic weed killer, for example, this is not biological warfare. So, hostile purposes. Now, today, with the evolution in biotechnology in its various facets, increasingly such a definition is becoming too narrow, especially since there are some new categories of agents that are emerging. And probably the ones with the most important application or potential application for biological warfare are peptides and other bioregulators. I'll come back to them. Another question that comes up, and I will briefly touch upon it later too, are so-called anti-materiel agents. So biological agents that act against dead, inanimate objects. So this is the point. Now, what is the threat of biological warfare? There is a lot of talk about this in the press. Most of it, and I can assure you almost 90% of it you read in the press is exaggerated. It's bordering on hysterics and has nothing to do with what I believe is the biological warfare threat. I would break down the threat in two major components. One is what I would call the proliferation threat, and the other one, the threat posed by technological developments, potential threats, things that might happen in the future. In the proliferation, again, there are two dimensions to it. One part are existing concerns about number of countries, and probably the biggest concern which we've had for a couple of decades now is the biological weapon program in the former Soviet Union And even today in Russia, we're not certain that the program has stopped. I'll come back to that later too. Another country with absolute certainty of a biological weapon program is Iraq. And you are probably aware that Iraq is resisting inspections by international inspectors under UN Security Council resolutions. And it has gone to extraordinary lengths to hide its biological weapons program. Again, the question is why? Then the second aspect of proliferation is our new acquisition programs. And here again, I think the greatest concern is probably in the Middle East, as the continuing confrontation makes a number of countries, a couple of regimes, seek such weapons, especially to offset Israel's supposedly nuclear weapons. Southeast Asia is also a potential area of threat. And then a third aspect really is that new actors might come into play. And I'm thinking here of terrorists, since our experience with Onshin Rikyo in Japan in 94 and 95, when it released the nerve agent sarin, in 94 in Matsumoto in the village, 95 in the Tokyo underground system. We know now that Onshin Rikyo was also investigating biological warfare agents. And fortunately, while it is relatively easy to grow the agents themselves, the microbes and the viruses, spreading them is a major technological challenge, and they failed in that respect. Now, for technological developments, we have to look at two very distinct processes that are taking place. One is product improvements. So we're getting new types of agents, which is definitely becoming possible as a consequence of biotechnology, that new agents get engineered in the laboratories. At the same time, the people working on that can also engineer the antidotes, the measures to protect oneself against it. And of course, if such a situation were to emerge in the future, you get into a situation whereby one state or one actor has a monopoly and the other states do not. So in such a situation, probably you don't even have to use the weapons. Threatening to use them would already be enough to get political or economic concessions. Product improvements can also take place in terms of new delivery systems. The agents can remain the same, but you can improve the way the agents are delivered on to the target. Some of these elements of progress which we've seen in the past is, for example, discovery by the United States during the Second World War, how to use aerosols to disperse such agents. So you have particles, the particles must have the right size to be able to enter your lungs, and that technology was developed during the war to have a maximum of particles of the right size. Other elements, and this is taking place in the civilian area, essentially are process improvements. And here we're looking both at research techniques and production techniques. In the research techniques, the way people, researchers, are going about sequencing genes, for example, the Human Genome Project. If you have followed the history of the Human Genome Project, you will probably remember the slow start and all of a sudden this enormous acceleration as new techniques, new processes became available. So in the laboratories, in the research, there are incremental improvements, but each of these improvements can cause an order of magnitude in increase in speed in doing the research. Production techniques are something very similar. Probably one of the greatest improvements in production techniques of the recent decades is the computerization of the fermentization process. So it enabled you not only to put several fermenters together in batteries, but most importantly, it allowed the production in 24-hour cycles. The batches became much larger, and the quality of the batches was also much higher, as the balances of the ingredients you had to put inside the fermenter could be better calibrated. So there is the element of process optimization. Various of these aspects I'm going to come back at a later stage in the presentation. Now, as I've said, I'm going to give you a historical overview, and the point I probably want to get across most is that in different times, people have had different conceptions of what disease is. The important point to bear in mind is, and probably even today, the way we view disease is a social construct of our times. But the most important point is that whatever way you construct the environment in which a disease occurs, peoples have always found ways of maximizing these insights for hostile purposes. It's absolutely not something new we are talking about. Well, one of the elements which is probably critical in the whole story, the whole history of biological warfare, is the fact that until probably the Second World War, perhaps the Vietnam War, that in any battle, in any conflict, more soldiers were lost to disease than to casualties from combat. Every army suffered from that. So disease was always a major preoccupation of armed forces throughout the history. The second element in the historical overview that's important to bear in mind is that until the late 19th century, there was no real understanding of what disease was and what caused disease and how disease was So if we go back to antiquity, to the Greek civilization and so, a general understanding of disease was what we could call a miasmic understanding. That it's the stories of bad odors, bad smells, vapors that are in the environment, and if you pass through these vapors, you become infected. Now, this is not very efficient for biological warfare as we understand it. However, we know from historical accounts that there have been efforts to draw troops into certain areas that were known to be to have these bad vapors at certain times in the year. And one story is, of course, the siege of Syracuse by the Greeks on Sicily in 414 before Christ. And there, in two consecutive years, defenders, the Syracusians, were able to draw the Greeks into the marshlands, and they suffered enormous casualties, leading to demoralization, and after the second summer, they had to withdraw from the island. Under today's standards, this would probably not be considered as biological warfare, probably more as perfidy. But it shows that the people had a certain concept of disease and they were able to exploit it for military purposes. A second phase in the understanding of disease is what I would call the pollution of the environment. It's not something that just comes out of the ground or is in nature, but you can cause disease yourself one way or another. How it happens, you didn't know. But you knew that corpses were bad, that corpses would start to stink at a certain point, and that all kinds of putrid characteristics would come to the fore. So you take corpses of animals or even humans, and you dump them in wells, drinking water supplies, and so on, and nobody is going to drink from that. So that was one way. And a second way in which that understanding was exploited was catapulting bodies over the walls of besieged cities. And this is, according to some stories, it cannot be proven, of course, but this is probably how the plague epidemic of the Middle Ages hit Europe, when during the siege of Kaffa in the Crimea, the Mongols catapulted bodies of diseased people over the walls, and the Genoese, who owned the city at that time as a merchant outpost, fled from the city. And one can reconstruct how the disease went into a stepwise fashion from one port to another to reach the Mediterranean area and then to spread over the rest of Europe. So that's polluting the environment. The next phase is what happens, say, the 18th century and later up to the First World War, is realization that disease is in fact an unhealthy condition of the body. So you know that it's not really something out there in the environment, but something that's inside the body. And once you know that, the things, objects which are in the possession of diseased people, you can use them, you can presume that they are also infected, and you pass them on to other people. And this is what happened in North America with the Indians, when, at least in one known instance, during the siege of Fort Pitt, 1763, that smallpox had broken out inside the fort. The blankets and some other gifts were given to the Indians, and the Indians, who were far less resistant to the disease than Europeans were, got ill, and basically they were exterminated because of that. So in that case, probably more than anything else which I've said so far, a lot of the story I'm going to tell you about is about dual use technology, the ability to use technology for civilian purposes, to use them for military purposes. But here, with that growing understanding as disease as an unhealthy condition of the body, here we already see that knowledge which exists to help people surviving epidemics is already being used to cause epidemics in hostile purposes. This transition is very easily made. In that same period, towards the end of the 18th century, because of that novel understanding, we also see the emergence of the first vaccines, incidentally, against smallpox. The way people in the West dealt with smallpox was first inoculation. So you took some fluids from a person who had a mild attack of smallpox, you inoculated, you put it into the body of somebody else in the hope that that person would also have a mild attack of the disease and then become immune to it. With vaccination, you're using something which is not really dangerous to a person. In that case, the discovery was cowpox. I mean, humans can have it, but it's absolutely not fatal. But somebody exposed to cowpox couldn't get smallpox. So once that connection had been made, then it was a question of extracting fluids of somebody who had been exposed to cowpox and vaccinate other people with it. And that, but this is not biological warfare, created a different type of advantage in warfare. Because, as I've said, disease is very much the scourge of all armies throughout the times. Somebody who's vaccinated has a strategic advantage over an army that's not vaccinated, because you have far fewer troops dropping out of the ranks. You retain a stronger army. Now, from here, we can jump almost straight to the First World War. On the eve of the First World War, the major bacterial diseases have been isolated, and already they were being cultivated in laboratories. Viral diseases had already been discovered, but their workings were not yet well understood. Parasitic diseases were being studied, and on the whole, there was a better understanding of how disease was transmitted from one person to another. So these understandings led to better prophylaxis, better prevention of disease, even something as simple as washing the hands, which was like a big issue in the 19th century, had a major impact. And also in terms of countermeasures such as vaccines and so on. But these insights were already used for the first time for hostile purposes in the First World War. And I must say that Germany led the way in that case too. Cultures of certain animal diseases, there was no talk of acts against humans, it was against animals. Some cultures were smuggled to the United States in 1915, who was not yet in the war at that time. They were cultivated in secret laboratories in the German mission in Washington, and then agents, American collaborators and German agents, went to the harbors where live stock draft animals, such as horses and so, which America sent over to Europe to help the war effort, both in terms of, horses were still being used to draw carts in those days. It was not yet all that mechanized. Also, cows and so on were important for food. So they tried to kill the animals in these ways. There were some animals killed, but far too few to have any impact at all on the outcome of the war. In the literature, you might come across some other allegations by the Allied powers, but these are unproven. Another thing which had a great impact on the perception of disease and the dangers it may pose as a weapon, people not necessarily thought of such weapons in offensive terms, was also very much, what if the enemy were to use such weapons against me? So that was, for many countries, the rationale to take up research into biological warfare. And of course, in 1918 was the outbreak of that great Spanish flu epidemic that killed about 20 million people, which in fact is more than the total number of casualties from the hostilities during the First World War on all fronts. So that had such a huge impact on the mindset of people in those days. Now, in the period between the Second World Wars, there were these rumors and what we know now to be proven facts of use of biological warfare agents for sabotage. There was the Great Flu. But during the interbellum, the concern about biological warfare grew enormously. There were also the technological improvements. But what stimulated the research, especially in France, the United Kingdom, and Canada, was false intelligence that Germany had set up a major program. There was very little to go, but the rumors went that there had been testing in the underground system of Paris, that the agents had been released over larger areas to see what happened, and that set off really some major programs. In World War II, that belief continued and was definitely the major impetus for the United States to start what at that time was the largest BW program ever. It began in 1942. The United States, United Kingdom and Canada joined in a trilateral cooperation between them, both to design weapons, to investigate agents, which ones are the most promising ones, and in the end to have joint production. The United States being very interesting in the sense that it could not be reached by enemy forces, so there was that kind of safety in terms of production. However, by 1945, by the end of the war, there had been no production of biological weapons except for relatively primitive anthrax cattle cakes, which were cakes that were regularly distributed to cattle in England. Holes were made in it, anthrax spores were inserted in the holes, it was plugged, and the idea was to use it in retaliation should Nazi Germany have started biological warfare. But again, the stress is very much on warfare against animals and not against humans. Nazi Germany, there was no coordinated program whatsoever. There was no weaponization of such weapons. One of the reasons which we recognize from the literature is that there was this order from Hitler not to embark on a biological warfare program. Himmler had different ideas about that, and this is also one of the reasons why you see some isolated programs at some institutes, but the institutes never coordinated with each other, so there was nothing in Nazi Germany. And the only country then to actually use biological warfare agents was Japan, already in the 1930s in China. It had a major research and development program into agents and delivery systems, and probably the most gruesome aspect of it is that it did its research with human experiments, and that on the people who were infected by these agents, they did live vivisection, because they thought that they couldn't look into the diseased organs of a dead person that would already lead to necrosis and some other aspects. And as I've said, it was used against Russians and Chinese. One of the big tragedies in the whole thing is that the Americans thought that biological warfare was such a great thing that they gave immunity to the Japanese war criminals in order to get the results of those human experiments. And in fact, they proved to be useless. After the Second World War, most of the countries engage in defensive research and development, protection, medical research, and so on, and that goes on until today. United States had a very large program, looked into many agents, several types of delivery systems, bombs, up to missiles, aerosols, spray tanks, and so on. However, the American program was terminated in 1969 by President Richard Nixon, and following that decision, the stockpiles were destroyed. This was probably one act that contributed greatly to achieving the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention in 1972. In the Soviet Union, in contrast, the story is quite different. Their program actually accelerated after 1972, after the conclusion of the convention, and accelerated both in scopes. The program expanded enormously, involving tens of thousands of people in a variety of research institutes all over the country. They looked into the genetic manipulation of pathogens to improve even their quality, and even to overcome the known antibiotics the West had, for example. And the case I'm referring to here is the anthrax strain 836, which is also the type of anthrax that escaped from Sverdlovsk, now Yekaterinburg, in 1979. Then they also developed tactical and strategic capabilities. Tactical, essentially, battlefield use of such a weapon. Strategic is to attack cities in the rear, both European towns and in the United States. And I must say, for the largest part of the time I've been dealing with chemical and biological warfare, I've heard about that, and it's only recently that it has come to my notice. To give you an indication of the size of the program and the types of weapons being considered, I knew, I had heard what I at the time considered to be rumors that they had actually weaponized biological warfare agents for ballistic missiles, intercontinental ballistic missiles. And this is now has now proved to be true. They also had strategic bombers set aside for biological warfare attacks. However, even in the late 1980s, they had a number of SS-18 intercontinental ballistic missiles. You must know these are the ones with 10 nuclear warheads. They had a couple of them set aside to have each of the 10 warheads filled with anthrax. These missiles were ready at all times, and they had the Soviets had 20 tons of anthrax ready at all time for use, and these 20 tons were replenished every year. That was like the storage time they had for these agents. They could keep it. So every year, these 20 tons were replenished. And this program has been going on at least until the end of the 1980s, and we still don't know whether it has fully terminated. Probably the weaponization phase has been terminated, but research and development might still go on. It's really a big problem of civilian control over the military. The military continue in their independent cells with a number of military researchers, and they defy all civilian control probably until today. Other concerns, as I've already indicated, is Iraq. We don't know what Iraq still has. It might be considerable, but nothing in terms of what I've described for the Soviet Union and Russia. And the fourth country that had a post-World War II program is South Africa. That program is essentially atypical. I mean, they mostly developed a number of weapons, a number of agents for assassination purposes. So they were going to look into anthrax, but they were going to put anthrax in the filters of cigarettes or in food. So if somebody smoked a cigarette, would definitely get the lethal dose into the lungs and eventually die. They've also used cholera in the war in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. But the effects weren't really that significant. People got ill, people have died on an individual level. It was, of course, dramatic. But in terms of military advantage with biological weapons, this was not the case. Now, having had this history, if we summarize everything now, what are the methods of use you can use biological weapons for? Well, the first one, as I've indicated with South Africa, is assassination. You kill an individual person. Toxins are excellent for that person. During the Cold War, people were assassinated. There are true stories, it's almost James Bond, but these are true stories of umbrellas with a pellet with ricin, which is pressed against the leg of somebody. The pellet enters, 2-3 days later, the person dies. These are documented stories. A second method of use is the military use against humans. This is essentially what I've been talking about. And here we have to make the distinction between strategic use, which is really covering massive areas, essentially civilian population, or tactical use, battlefield use. The other distinction one can make is between lethal, that is with the intention of killing people, or incapacitating, that is to render people impossible to function for a certain time. So just to give you an example of that, you know what diphtheria is, you know what its effects are. So if you expose troops to diphtheria, you can imagine for a couple of hours they're not going to function on the battlefield. And of course it's then interesting for you to go forward with your conventional attack, because the other troops are completely weakened by it. Then, as we have seen in the case of the First World War, it can be used for military purposes against livestock. It can be used against plants. That was being considered during the Second World War, especially if the mainland of Japan were to be invaded. There were the Americans had plans to attack rice fields, for example. So you deny the food to your enemy. And then the most recent one is military use against materiel. Now, one little point I want to make in this context, and you've probably noticed that I haven't yet used that evil term, what I consider to be an evil term of weapon of mass destruction. You will notice with all these different ways of using biological weapons that much of it is not weapon of mass destruction, not at all. And in my mind, using that term just obfuscates many of these other uses, and probably many of the uses that are much more likely. The use against humans is probably not the greatest threat in biological warfare, even in the future. It's the use against plants. It's the use, perhaps, against animals. Anyway, this is something which was probably better on the slide, but in terms of agents, well, I'm just going to list them quickly. You have bacteria, you have the viruses, you have fungi, rickettsia, which are like parasitic microscopic agents, which cause typhus, to say one. There are toxins. These are really chemical products, but they're very often included under biological weapons because they are naturally produced by living organisms. One of the more well-known toxins is snake venom, for example. But in military terms, we're thinking of botulinus toxin, saxitoxin, the mycotoxins. You've perhaps heard of it in the context of Southeast Asia. And then the new categories of bioregulators. In a bioregulator, again, it's a chemical compound which regulates inside your body your central nervous system. Bioregulators, the function is, as it says, to regulate the way that impulses are transferred. If one way or another you increase the amount of the substance, you give the person an overdose, you expose him to an overdose of that, his entire nervous system ceases to function in normal way, and the person can get ill or can be killed because of heart failure, whatever. So in that way, it functions very similarly to nerve agents as chemical weapons. In terms of delivery systems, what do we have to think of? Well, there are insect and animal vectors. You know, plague, for example, the rat carries the plague. Then you have the mosquito, the flea that bites the rat. That flea then bites the human. The bacteria is transferred. So these are animal vectors. Then you have the traditional weapons in terms of spray systems, shells and bombs and ballistic missiles. But probably also much more important for future concern is that the weapon systems, in essence, may remain the same. A bomb is going to be a bomb. A missile is going to be a missile. A spray system, a spray system. Is that the way the agent enters the body and works inside the body is being improved. And this is happening essentially through cancer research, where a whole number of chemotherapies and other medication is being developed. And you all know that chemotherapy has very nasty side effects. But if you, and that's because it targets other cells besides the one it really should target. So if you can focus your chemotherapy on the diseased cell rather than healthy ones, or even better, if you can target your medication on that part of the genetic string that causes cancer, then of course you're not going to have these side effects. Your medication is going to be much more efficient. Translated to military terms, if you can insert it in such a way that it affects part of the gene, then you can exploit genetic characteristics of a certain person. So if, for example, you are able to isolate that part of your genetic composition that makes you a black person or makes you have white hair, you can eliminate that part of the population and not other parts of the population. Now, this is still very much science fiction, but the theoretical possibility is there definitely. I'm talking, the techniques don't exist yet, but if we are thinking in terms of 20, 30 years into the future, this might become a reality, and it has to be blocked right now. Better now than later. So this is an overview of how biological warfare has evolved over the ages, how the new technology is getting into it. The question is, can we control such developments? The current control regimes, the ones which we've had that deal explicitly with biological weapons, are really very few. The first ones I would mention is probably the 1899-1907 Hague Conventions. The reason for mentioning it is that it prohibits the use of poisons under all circumstances. And in those days, many of the diseases were still to be called or considered to be poisoning. So in terms of the understanding of the concept in the late 19th century, early 20th century, that convention was applicable. The next agreement, we have to go to 1925, which is Geneva Protocol, that prohibits the use, in reality, the first use of chemical and biological weapons. Somebody, the Polish delegation, had the foresight of including biological weapons into that. And then we make a great leap to 1972. Pardon? Then we make that great leap to 1972, to the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention, that prohibits development, production, possession of biological weapons, or the destruction of them. The funny thing is that it does not contain an explicit prohibition on use, but that was because of the Geneva Protocol. Today, the understanding is that use is also covered. And then, of course, we have the 1993 Chemical Weapons Convention, which also covers a number of toxins, which are also covered by the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention. Now, if we go to the latest two treaties, the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention and the Chemical Weapons Convention, you probably realize immediately that there are millions of toxic chemicals, there are millions of disease-causing organisms or poisonous substances out there in the world. However can you control that? Making a list doesn't happen. Just think of flu. It changes every year. Influenza changes every year. I mean, how can you insert that into a list? So the way these treaties deal with it is by a mechanism that's called the general purpose criterion. Now, this is a very important, I think the person whoever devised it in 1933 in the first draft convention, disarmament convention, I think that person must have been a genius. In fact, what it does, the general purpose criterion, and the stress is on the word purpose, it doesn't prohibit objects. It doesn't ban an agent because it's a chemical. It doesn't ban anthrax because it's a biological warfare agent. It cannot do that. But what it does ban are the purposes to which one might apply these chemicals, these biological agents. So not the objects as such are prohibited, but the purposes to which they can be used. And of course, you're going to ask me, a biological weapon, a chemical weapon, if you do not ban the object, what is it? Well, the reasoning is you have certain objects that have no other purpose than being a chemical weapon or a biological weapon. And through this way, they are prohibited, the objects are prohibited under the convention. So just bear this understanding in mind for the general purpose criterion, because this is going to be the key factor in terms of trying to control biological weapons in the future, irrespective of technological developments. Just for technical matter, in the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention, if you come across it, it's in Article 1, and in the Chemical Weapons Convention, it's contained in Articles 2 and 6. So, general purpose criterion is the central element. How does that fit with our understanding of technology? Most of us will immediately think of technology as objects. But this is an old understanding of technology. Technology today has a much broader understanding. Indeed, it has several components in it. It has materials and artifacts, which are objects. Of course, I mean, a machine is technology. It's an artifact. But it also involves the capital to develop and produce that artifact. It involves knowledge and skills. You have to know how to design such a machine. If you have a problem, you have to know how to solve that particular problem and how to apply technological insights to it. And skills, you must know how to operate it. You must know how to design it. And then even further, once the object has been created, you need principles, techniques, and systems for the management of research, development, and production processes. So technology is all of that together. You really have to think of something as encompassing all these various components at the same time. As you know, if we speak of materials and artifacts and the capital, these are what we call the tangibles, the things you can touch, the things you can see. The other part, the knowledge, the skills, the managerial processes and systems, these are the intangibles. You cannot control, you cannot control them. You cannot see them, you cannot touch them. And in biological warfare-related issues, the core problem is going to be not to control the agents, it's going to be to control these intangibles, the knowledge, data, information, and so on. So now that we have expanded this idea of technology, we come to the concept of dual-use technology. Because in biological warfare, for biological weapons, almost everything, if not everything, is dual-use in nature. In chemical weapons, this is quite a big distinction. In chemical weapons, it's dual use up to a certain level. But once you start creating some agents, some of the agents like sarin, like Tabun, VX, and so on, they are used for no other purpose than for being a chemical weapon. So there is no dual use anymore involved in these agents. The bombs, the spray tanks that are developed to deliver these, they have no other use, they have no commercial use, so that's single use. But in biological, with their biological weapons, I mean, it's almost right up to the end that you're going to have the problem of dual use. Now, what does the concept of dual use mean? One, it means that it has military and civilian application, the both together. It can be used for civilian purposes and for civilian application. And this dual application happens today, it's current, or it has the potential. So the concept of dual use is something that's also potentially there. And this is the concern, in my mind, probably the greater threat than the current weapon stockpiles, is that the potential of much of the developments in the biotech sector, which today is entirely for legitimate civilian purposes, can be used on time to transpose it for military purposes. So, potential. So, to repeat, military and civilian, current or potential or future. Now, this dual-use characteristic of a lot of the technology involved for biological weapons makes that it becomes very difficult to control. I mean, civilian applications are legitimate, and they are everywhere. We use it in agriculture, we use it for medicinal research, we use it in health. Every day, I don't think we can escape biotechnology today, one way or another. But because of that expansion, because of that central role, even in development of countries, for underdeveloped countries, even in development, it's taking such a central role in reaching more advanced stages, it becomes very difficult to control. So if we place controls on them, you're going to have the problem of political and ethical issues. Political issues, because if you're going to deny it to a developing country, the country is saying, hey, you're hegemonistic, you're creating a monopoly, you do not want it. If you're doing it for health reasons, for example, one country in Africa or Asia is ravaged by epidemics, the biotechnology is there to treat them, but you do not want to pass it on because of security concerns, the country is going to say, hey, where's your ethics in the whole matter? People are dying, you're not helping us. More people are dying from the disease and from biological weapons. So this is the crux of our problem today, how to resolve these contradictions. Now, what I'm going to tell you right now is probably not widely accepted, and I know within my project it's not even accepted. But anyway, this is my view on it. The question is, are we going to consider this dual-use characteristic of technology? Are we going to consider the technology to be intrinsically dual-use? That means, is it a property of that particular technology, which is always present under all circumstances? It's just part of it. Or is the dual-use characteristic an attribute, something that it acquires under certain circumstances? Now, the answer to that has major implications for arms control and disarmament. Because in the first case, you will have to control objects. And you will have to control all objects in it that can contribute to the creation of a biological weapon. And this goes very far. And here I'm paraphrasing Les Aspin, who was Defense Secretary in the United States in 1993, when he expressed the idea. And one of the journalists asked, the pencil with which I'm writing, that too? Yes, he said, that too. So you're controlling everything. Everything is dual use, everything poses a threat. Is that acceptable? I don't know. If it's an attribute, then you control the circumstances in which the dual use transfer takes place. So, you can probably already guess that my favorite interpretation is the second one, because otherwise I don't think you go anywhere. There are always going to be accusations of proliferation and nowhere. And one of the reasons why I think that the attribute approach is a more relevant one is precisely going back to the general purpose criterion. That is, not the object is prohibited, but the purpose to which it is used. So which means if you have a object for civilian purposes, you transfer it to military purposes, you give it the attribute of dual use. The dual use potential that the object has is realized in the transfer to a military application. And this is prohibited by the convention. So it's almost a question to give you a simple image. In your kitchen, you have a knife. Okay. In the first version, that knife is going to be a threat under all circumstances. It can kill a person in your household. In the other situation, you're not going to consider the knife a threat if it's in the drawer or if you use it for cooking. However, if I am angry and extremely upset and I have a knife in my hand, these are the circumstances that make the knife threatening because I could use it against somebody in my anger. So this is like... Is it okay? Oh, okay. So this is like the circumstances here you want to control. So to use the metaphor again, what you want to do is prevent me getting angry so that I would use the knife as a murder weapon. But the knife per se is not a murder weapon, so you can buy it freely in the shops and so on. Otherwise, you might perhaps require a license, as for guns. Okay, so to go the one step further, to come to this little chart for which I then hope to use the beamer, what we have is then, if you have a certain technology, and it's designed for civilian purposes, and you use it ultimately for civilian purposes, this is single-use technology. If you have a technology which you've developed for civilian purposes, you use it for military purposes, you realize the dual-use potential. I mean, anything is potentially dual-use, but you realize it in that particular transfer. Once that object, once that technology is in military hands, and they continue to use it for military purposes, you again have the single-use situation. And the latter element is what I've already given the example of, a chemical weapon. I mean, you bring all kinds of technologies together, many of which are civilian. You put it in a weapon that is single-use, has no other purpose than being used as a chemical weapon. This can happen the other way around too, from military technologies to civilian ones. That happens all the time. I mean, the best example is probably our Teflon pan, which was developed for the Saturnus moon missions, and we're still using it. So civilian transfer from civilian to military is typically what we call the spin-on, and military to civilian is the spin-off of technology. So can now the beamer be switched on? Can the beamer be switched on? No? But in
can you ask the microphone?
Oh, okay. No. Okay. So what I've done here is create a small chart where you can see what happens under the Biological Weapons Convention. The Biological Weapons Convention identifies permitted purposes. So you can use all the technologies for things it does not prohibit. So medical research, protection against biological weapons, detection of that, all of that is permitted. There are also the prohibited purposes, anything that leads to the use of technologies for biological warfare, pardon me, in an offensive way is prohibited. But there is a second dimension. We have civilian applications and we have military applications in it. Now, from each of these categories, you can have technology transfers in any direction. What does the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention do? Everything which is here on the right side is totally prohibited. So any technology transfer which goes from left to right is utterly prohibited under the convention, also this one. The ones that go from right to left, here and here, there is a single time that the technology transfer, the dual use potential, may be realized, is authorized to be realized. That is namely for the conversion of production facilities, equipment, and so forth for the peaceful purposes. So when a state became or becomes a party to the convention, it has this one opportunity to have military technologies transferred for civilian applications. This is a one-off. And then what you have today is this, are these two. These are the two critical ones, where you have civilian technologies going to military purposes and military research and development going into civilian applications. This is happening all the time. So what I'm saying is, under the convention, anything that contributes to B and D are utterly prohibited by the convention. Between A and B, the transfers, each time you cross the yellow boundary, you have a realization of dual use potential. These are prohibited. And as these are civilian and military, in my view, it's up to your personal ethics whether you find that acceptable or not. But under the convention, there is nothing in it that prohibits that. And as I've already indicated in the historical overview, many countries have military defensive programs. Most of these programs are open. I mean, the people working in the programs publish in the open literature. There are exchanges between researchers. They participate in conferences and so on. What you have, of course, is that in the military programs, they are focusing essentially on things that have to do with the threat of biological warfare. They're looking into defenses. And as you're looking into defenses, you also gain a lot of understanding of offensive research. So again, we are creating technologies, understandings that have a potential dual use, dual utility, but then dual use in this sense that it could go from permitted to non-prohibited purposes at some point in the future. Okay, beamer can be switched off again.
The whole thing then becomes in
the whole thing then becomes in terms of controlling these flows, in controlling the potential dual use application. And this is not something for today, this is also something for the future, especially for the future, because we have to control things that we don't even know of today, and which we know can happen at extremely fast paces. So to conclude in terms of the biological and toxin weapons regime, I wish to stress the centrality of that general purpose criterion. This is the key to whatever control we can have in the future. And what is necessary for that is a permanent reinterpretation of the general purpose criterion, so that everybody is very clear that novel technological developments in biotechnology and so on, even in chemistry today, are covered by the GPC, General Purpose Criterion. Fortunately, the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention has review conferences every 5 years, and there's going to be one now in November and December of this year. And every 5 years, all new technological developments over these past 5 years are considered, and the relevant statement is made that the scope of the convention covers these new things. This is very fortunate. It also has an impact, of course, on verification and the monitoring. Right now, the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention has no verification mechanisms whatsoever. There are a couple of voluntary confidence-building measures which were agreed upon in the review conferences. But under right now, in Geneva, people are trying to negotiate a protocol to the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention so that there would be greater confidence in that treaty regime. But what you have to do is verify and monitor not the objects. I mean, you cannot monitor anthrax. Here in this room, if we would do a swipe over the carpet, we would turn up anthrax spores. If you go outside among the plants, you would even find more anthrax spores. They're everywhere, they're omnipresent. So you cannot deal with objects. So we have to deal with the purposes. And my criticism, my big concern with the protocol is that, one, there is very little verification in it. It's much more of confidence-building measures and transparency-enhancing measures, but they focus on objects. They do not focus on purpose. It's an old understanding of technology. I mean, the whole negotiation takes place in an atmosphere of Cold War negotiations. This is still very much the idea that permeates the negotiations. So there is very little way that the intangibles, the thing which I've identified as being so crucial in the novel biotechnology, there's no way of dealing with that, of dealing with information. It's information generation is critical to the biotechnology more than anything else. So how are we going to deal with that? The only way we can do it right now is via export controls that you deny people access. Students from certain countries cannot come to study in your country, or you're prohibited from going to certain countries. But even so, with the internet, modern information technology, that goes. So the big question in my mind is that even if the negotiators will achieve a protocol at the end of this year, and I doubt they will, but even if they do, my big question is it going to be a failure? Because it doesn't control the things it should control first and foremost. And I think that what we have to undertake, and this is a call to scientists in different branches, this is definitely a multidisciplinary undertaking, that is to have a new conceptual approach to technology, and as a consequence of that, to have a new conceptual approach to verification. Because it's those intangibles we have to catch much more than the objects. Thank you very much.